American Cassette Ministries takes great pleasure in presenting Dr. Agatha Thrash, one of America's foremost lecturers and authors on the subject of alternative preventative medicine. Prior to entering the field of preventative medicine, Dr. Agatha Thrash, a physician, practiced pathology for 15 years. Her husband, Calvin, also a physician, practiced internal medicine for 20 years. The doctors Thrash co-founded Uchi Pines Institute, a medical missionary training center in Seal, Alabama, and have authored various books including Home Remedies, Nutrition for Vegetarians, Natural Remedies, The Animal Connection, and Eat for Strength, a vegetarian cookbook. Two new books have just been published entitled More Natural Remedies and Food Allergies Made Simple. Dr. Agatha Thrash has appeared on television and radio interviews and has lectured throughout the United States and Canada, as well as in Norway, Puerto Rico, Bermuda, and the Orient. And now, Dr. Agatha Thrash, in another presentation designed to help you live a happier, healthier, and longer life.
Our topic for this morning is that of sugar and how it affects the body. There is much that we know about sugar in the last several years, maybe about the last 10 years. In the medical literature, there has been much written about sugar and its ill effects on the body, especially when sugar is taken with fats. Take the experiment that was done on a national level in Eskimo land when the Alcan Highway went through in 1953. Along with it went sugar and Dixie Crystals, went Cokes and Pepsis and lots of sugar, so that Eskimos jumped from using about 25 pounds of sugar per person per year in 1950 to 8 short years later, 125 pounds of sugar per person per year. They had always had a high-fat diet with seal blubber and whale blubber. But with the addition of this amount of sugar to the diet, this brought a train of illnesses, emotional illnesses, physical illnesses, such disorders as carious teeth, diabetes, gallbladder disease, acne. All of these things were experienced for the first time by Alaskan Eskimos. This has been our experience in our patients also. When sugar and fats are mixed together, especially sugar and milk, which are essentially sugar and fats, we do find that we have a great deal of problem with these various diseases. Now, too much sugar can bring on a number of different kinds of diseases. When we eat a meal that has a lot of sugar in it, the sugar level rises high in the blood right away. So, because of the fact that the blood is more thick and more difficult for the heart to pump around, all of our body systems are immediately designed to dissipate sugar from the blood. And so, liver takes some, kidneys take some, muscles take some, and the skin takes a good bit. In fact, the skin can take up quite a large quantity. Much of the sugar in any meal will be stashed away in the skin for a while for its as its storage space or place until the time that the body can accept some more, and then the skin or the blood can accept some more, and then the skin begins to put more sugar back into the blood gradually. But this process may take some 4 or 5 hours. So the skin during all that time has an excess load of sugar in it, and this excess load of sugar makes it so that it's more likely to get acne, more likely to get infections of various kinds, impetigo is more likely to occur, and a lot of other disorders of the skin, including fungus infections. These are all more likely to occur in the individual who has a lot of sugar to remove from the blood and put out in the skin. So we can expect that all of these organs that can accept sugar, such as muscles and kidneys and liver, that any of these might have a problem because of the fact that just these organs simply have more sugar in them right after a meal, much more than is helpful for them to contain. Then a number of metabolic diseases result from our having too much sugar. Of course, everybody would understand diabetes, but from diabetes comes a train of other illnesses. There is no illness that we know, whether it be mental or social or physical, that is not more. There is just more of it, more intense and more of them when a person has diabetes. So we recommend a lifestyle that will not tend toward diabetes, because with diabetes comes certain amount of neuropathy, the neuropathy of anesthesia or increased sensitivity of various parts, such as burning on the soles of the feet, or pains here and there, or a sensitivity, so that if the skin is touched, instead of just feeling a touch, one feels a tremendous touch. It's almost like a pain, the touch is so great. All of these can fall in the wake of diabetes. Then, of course, heart and artery disease, from the fact that sugar and fats, when they are together in the blood, do make a big problem for the heart valves and the interior of the blood vessels, probably also for the muscle of the blood vessels. So all of these are problems that we encounter when a person has sugar disease. Now, I'd like to talk with you just a little bit about our white blood cells. We have a number of different kinds of white blood cells in the body. White blood cells are for the purpose of making antibodies. There's a certain type of white blood cell called the lymphocyte. Lymphocytes are responsible for making antibodies. There are other white blood cells that are responsible for attacking an invader, say an invading germ. The germ invades the body, and we have a neutrophil right there, ready to engulf, or will have it ready shortly to engulf the germ, because the germ itself sends out a chemical, it sort of has an aroma, and the neutrophils are sensitive to this, what we could call an aroma. It is a chemical material. We call that chemotaxis. But the neutrophil is sensitive to that chemical, so it begins to migrate toward the germ. And when it gets toward the germ, it begins to engulf the germ. It just flows over it, so to speak, takes it inside of its own body. The ordinary neutrophil, if it has access to some very palatable germs, can eat about 14 germs in half an hour. Now that's quite an efficient little soldier that you have there. Think of if every American soldier in times of combat could destroy 14 of the enemy soldiers, that would be quite an efficient soldier if he could do that every half an hour around the clock. What a soldier that would be. But we have such a soldier who is capable of defending us against germs. That is, he is quite an efficient soldier. That is, if we don't do anything to him to mar his efficiency. And I'm going to talk about that in just a bit. Now we have another important type of white blood cell. This is called the monocyte. The monocyte is just as important as the other two, the one that makes the antibody, the one that attacks the soldier, the enemy. But we have another one too, and this is the cleanup crew. This is called a monocyte. The monocyte is a large, slow-moving cell. The other two are quick-moving cells and are rather small. But the monocyte is large, and as it moves along, it just sort of takes everything in its wake. All the debris of the battles that have gone on beforehand, it just mops that up. We require them also. If we didn't have them, we would not be able to handle infections and inflammations and injuries and repair in nearly so efficient a manner. It would take us months to do what we can do in just days with monocytes. Now, all of these precious soldiers that we have are injured by sugar. Let us just take the neutrophil as an example. How many germs can a neutrophil dispatch in half an hour? 14. All right, if we eat a mere 6 teaspoons of sugar, That would be what we could find in, say, one very small piece of angel food cake, or one moderate-sized brownie. So it's not very much, you see, just 6 teaspoons full of sugar. Then we draw the blood, we expose the germs to the white blood cells, and instead of eating 14 germs in half an hour, they can only eat 10, just from 6. Now, if we add to that brownie or that piece of angel food cake 1 Coke, that would take us up to about 12 teaspoons full of sugar. Then our white blood cells can only eat 5.5 germs in half an hour. Quite a reduction. We have done something that would injure our white blood cells by taking that much sugar at one time. Now, it's important that we not injure ourselves in any way. Seventh-day Adventists have taught for quite a long time that we should be very careful about the health. Let us take what is written in Councils on Diet and Foods, page 328. We should not be prevailed upon to take anything into the mouth that will bring the body into an unhealthy condition, no matter how much we like it. Why? Because we are God's property. No matter how much we like it, if it causes a problem to us, to the body, if it makes a problem for our white blood cells, we should not be prevailed upon to eat it no matter how much we like it, because of the necessity that we have of presenting our bodies, not our own property, but the property of God, but presenting these back to our Heavenly Father in perfect running condition. Now, so far as sugar is concerned, it affects not only our white blood cells, but it affects other cells as well. Reading also from page 328, I frequently sit down to the tables of the brethren and sisters and see that they use a great amount of milk and sugar. These clog the system. That's one thing that it does, clog the system. Number two, it irritates the digestive organs. And number three, what do you suppose this third thing is? Could anybody be willing to hazard a guess? It affects the brain. It affects the brain. Clogs the system. Now, that's not just, let's say, the digestive system. That clogs also our metabolic systems. Now, we learn about that from science. We learn about how the liver is clogged by this problem. We learn about how certain cycles in the making of energy, these are also clogged by sugar. Sugar can be a big problem for the body, metabolically speaking. It also irritates the digestive organs. Have you ever taken too much sugar and recognized that your stomach did not feel quite so good as it did before you ate that sugar? That's because of the irritating effect, and you might even have had other digestive difficulties as well. But because of the nature of the brain, it is likely that most of us do not really understand when the brain is hitting on only about 4 or 6 cylinders, when we really have about 10 or 12 that could be used. That's because of the fact that the brain is capable of filling in defects that we have. Let us take the blind spot that we have. Probably some of you know that if you look at a blank wall, nothing on it except just bricks, thousands of bricks all the way across. Do you know that there are spots where you cannot see the brick that are there? And if you were looking right at one spot and kept your eyes focused right on that one spot, at the place where your blind spot is, someone from behind the wall could remove several bricks, and as long as you continue to keep your eyes focused on that one spot, you would be totally unaware that the bricks were missing. And yet the mind does not know that there are missing spots in the brick wall, the so-called blind spot. The reason for that is because of our great ability to fill in. Well, we fill in not only with vision, but we fill in with a number of other things as well. We fill in things that we don't know, so that a person seeing an accident will fill in certain things that he didn't see. But he knows they must have happened, and so he thinks they did, and when he tells it, he tells those things as if he actually saw them. He saw them with a mind's eye, not with the actual vision. Because of this great ability, we are often not aware of the fact that there are great deficits in our memory, or great deficits in the ability that we have to put things together, to reason, to have judgment, to be critical of things, to decide whether something is good for us or is not good for us. We miss all of this, and yet we are totally unaware that we have missed it. Totally unaware. Drugs do this for us too. A study was recently done on blood pressure medications, and it was shown that blood pressure medications would cause quite a major deficit in memory, and yet those taking the blood pressure medication had no awareness at all that they had deficits in their memory. Quite an important understanding for us, this is, that we can know that things that we do to the body, such as eating too much sugar, can cause us to have a mental inefficiency, and yet we're unaware of it. We know that at times we can reason in a certain way, and so we assume that we can constantly reason in such a way. But I would like to read these three again. Sugar and milk, when taken together, these clog the system, irritate the digestive organs, and affect the brain. Now, in this matter of affecting the brain, how does it affect the brain? Does it affect you just in the way that you are able to figure out such things as a math problem? It does affect you that way. Does it affect you only in the way of making it so that you cannot reason such things as difficult theological concepts? Yes, it does affect you in that way also. But what about such things as crime? Would it affect you in that way too? Someone might say, well, never. I would never do anything criminal, not even if I took a whole pound of sugar. Well, you may not be aware that you're doing something criminal. You know, we can do a lot of things that are criminal in the mind only, not ever having it come out to the place where we do it with our hands. We can do things that are criminal with the mind. We can think a crime, and it is registered in heaven as a crime, even though we may not actually have committed a crime with the hands. We can do despicable things to our family members, or we can be jealous of someone. This is a mental activity only. It never gets down to the point of having something done with the hands, and yet it is registered in heaven as having been a crime. And so I would like to study that with you just for a moment. Let us take some of the material that has recently been published on the subject of crime, diet, and delinquency. From Science News for August 20th, 1983, there was a nice study published on the work done by a researcher named Thatcher. Thatcher and his colleagues discovered that the analysis of certain tissues of the body, such as hair, showed an altogether different spread of trace elements if the person was given to using junk foods. Let me just read a couple of lines from this report. Hair cadmium correlated. Now, cadmium is a killer trace metal. We don't like to have cadmium in the body. The less we can have, the better it is for us. Cadmium, however, is able to accumulate in the body based on the kind of lifestyle that we have. Hair cadmium correlated with the proportion of refined carbohydrates in the diet of 184 children studied. Refined carbohydrates include white sugar, white flour, white rice, white pasta. What is pasta?
Spaghetti
and macaroni. White pasta and synthetic instant potatoes. What it amounted to, says Thatcher, was the higher the proportion of the diet attributable to junk food, the higher the amount of cadmium in their hair. The scientists also reported that scores on tests to measure full-scale IQ or verbal IQ or performance IQ in reading and math appeared to have been adversely affected by the proportion of refined carbohydrates in the diet. So it involves not only the way that we can fight germs with our white blood cells, but the amount of sugar that we take involves also how keen we are, how well we can verbally express ourselves, how well we can be productive in a labor situation, or how well we can understand a variety of topics, our general full-scale IQ as well. Very important things we're now learning along these lines. Now, I'd like to present the matter of crime to you as well, since crime has been, in the last 10 years, been associated with an understanding of the fact that we do take in a lot of junk foods. Some researchers have done some very important work along those lines as well. Some researchers went to a prison where there were 18 to 22-year-old prisoners incarcerated. They found that in the prisoners who were violent, that there were several elements that were elevated and several elements that were depressed. Those that were elevated were lead, cadmium, iron, and calcium. Those were the ones that were elevated. The ones that were depressed were lithium, cobalt, and zinc. Now, zinc is a very important element. Zinc is present in very few foods in high quantity, and we need to eat good quality fruits and vegetables and whole grains. We especially need to get whole grains in order to get plenty of zinc. Whole grains and legumes, these can give us good quality. These are good sources of zinc. Now, many of these children, if they are young men, if they ate a lot of junk foods, they were not given to wanting greens and whole grains. And therefore, I think this is one of the reasons why zinc compounds were less common in their tissues than in those who were of less violent nature or not violent at all. Also, there is another matter, and that is the one of masturbation. Zinc compounds are lost in the genital fluids, and it could be that many individuals who later go into crime may have established the practice of masturbation early in life, and the loss of these zinc compounds may actually have something to do with the functioning of the brain. It is understood that in certain mental illnesses, zinc is low in quantity in the blood and in tissues. So it could be that this practice also may be one that injures the functioning of the brain. In another study, there were two patterns for violent boys discovered, which were distinctly abnormal as compared with normal boys living in the same socioeconomic groups and also having the same kinds of general diet. It was found that in violent boys, they were classified in two categories. One category was a category of trace element presence that that had a distinctive pattern if they were sporadically violent. That is, they weren't just across the board violent, but were sporadically violent. Now, by sporadically violent, I mean that they might have months and months of perfectly good behavior and then suddenly become violent. Then those that were for long periods of time violent, that is, all the time they were violent, these also showed a very specific, they simply fell into two very distinct groupings. Now, those who were episodically violent had high levels of lead, cadmium, and calcium, sodium, and potassium, those five elements. Those who were always antisocial had high levels of lead, cadmium, calcium, and copper, and low levels of sodium, lithium, zinc, cobalt, and potassium. So the researchers could simply by taking an analysis of their tissue, such as hair, they could determine whether or not the person was episodically violent, that is just once in a while, or whether he was continually antisocial. And both of these were distinctly different from normal boys. So they had three classifications in their 48 boys. The 24 violent boys showed one of the two patterns that I mentioned. All of the normal boys showed a distinctive normal pattern. With these studies, we can begin to understand that there are indeed differences in the way that people behave determined by the method in which they handle certain trace elements. And as we understand our lifestyles and see the fact that what we do to our bodies in the way of our lifestyle, such as the way that we eat, how we sleep, how we behave in our secret thoughts, that all of these things do indeed determine whether or not we're going to have violent behavior or nonviolent behavior. Now, how does all of this work out for us so far as how we behave from day to day? I would like to talk with you about a lifestyle that I think could be helpful to an individual who finds himself in any of these mental states, or a person who would be like to be very careful to avoid any of this kind of abnormal behavior. In a little book that we have called The Syllabus of Our Health Emphasis Seminar, we have on page one a discussion of depression. In order to avoid depression, first off, you must have proper thoughts. You must not have an unyielding disposition, nor must you violate any of the principles that you know to be moral principles. To do so often brings with it a sense of guilt or a sense of dishonor or disgrace or uselessness and hopelessness that brings with it depression. So to avoid depression, one of the things that we should do is to not be unyielding, but on the other hand, have high moral principles by which we consistently live. Then the second thing is that of regularity. If we will make our lives regular, going to bed on time, getting up on time, having meals on time, exercising on time, and doing every other thing that we can just on time, we will have a great benefit. We will be studying at a later time about circadian rhythms or the body's biologic time clocks and how important they are, far more important than most of us can realize. But some of the improper behavior that we get from an irregular schedule comes in as an illustration or are illustrated by the response that a nurse that I had as a patient one time had when she was just out of nurse's training. She found herself overwhelmed by debts. She needed an automobile, so she purchased an automobile, and that put her even farther in debt. So she had schooling debts, and then these debts that she was having to try to get herself established. So in the process of having these debts, she took one job after another, and finally she was working 3 8-hour shifts every day. Very fortunately, one of these 8-hour shifts just involved a sitting type of job, but it was sitting. She did have to sit, but she could sleep while she sat in the chair and watched the patient. To get between these three jobs required a dash. As soon as she was off from one, she would dash and be about 20 to 30 minutes late for the next one. But you can imagine how disordered this would make the life after just a few months. So after a while, she began to recognize she could not stay awake at important times. So just a little of amphetamine would not harm at all. So she took a little amphetamine. And then the time came pretty shortly when she could not sleep, even when she had a shift off. She could not sleep even then. So it was a little bit of barbiturate. And pretty soon, her life had so deteriorated and her judgment had been so impaired by this kind of thing that she decided a little Demerol would not hurt a bit. So she took a little Demerol, her patient's Demerol. She just gave it to herself and gave the patient the saline so that she could account for it. Well, this went on for some time until I'm sure you know the story and where it is leading. Pretty soon, she was a full-blown drug addict, stealing narcotics, stealing money to purchase syringes and things of this nature, just a full-blown drug addict. Now, that was about 10 years ago. To the present day, she is still struggling with drug addiction. And it is unlikely that her life will ever again be fully under control. We must not take the first step that leads toward loss of control. And first step for many of us is that of deliberately and willfully losing sleep. Now, this is not to say that the occasional time when we lose sleep, that this is going to destroy our mental balance. But if we deliberately and consistently do this, we can imagine that any kind of lack of regularity in the life can eventually lead to the point where we are out of control of our lives. Another thing, item number 4 in the depression routine, is that of being very careful to guard against overeating or undereating. A depression settles on the mind when we simply eat too much food. Now, the reason for that, you might say, well, I can combat that. I will just think, and I will just focus my mind, and I will concentrate, and I can overcome it. I have a strong mind, and ordinarily, I know that my mind is very strong and will not have a problem of concentration, so I will overcome it by sheer strength of mind. You have no ability to do that. I have often had patients tell me just before they were going under anesthesia, "Doctor, you can't put me to sleep." I guess I've had probably 5 or 6 people to tell me that through the years. "You can't put me to sleep." And I would say, "Well, just keep counting." And of course, you know the story, that the drug simply takes over from the individual and the person cannot keep the mind focused. It is the same kind of thing when we eat too much food. The presence of too much sodium in the blood makes a sort of a suppression of our production of norepinephrine. Now, norepinephrine is a kind of neurohormone that gives us alertness. It also gives us cheerfulness. Norepinephrine can help us to keep our lives organized and to be efficient. We need lots of norepinephrine. It is an important neurohormone for us, interfered with by sodium, by the increased amount of sodium. Well, someone might say, "Well, I'll just leave salt out of my food." Well, that would be a help, it is true. But all food comes with salt in it. It grows that way. It is produced with salt. produced with salt from the ground up. So we cannot avoid some degree of salt. And if you overeat, that simply increases the total quantity of sodium that you will be taking in. Now, potassium also causes a certain confusion of thoughts in the mind. This confusion of thoughts results from an imbalance of the electrical activity of the nervous system with every impulse that we send, no matter how small the impulse is. In order to propagate the impulse along a nerve process, we must put potassium out of the cell and sodium into the cell. And this goes along at lightning speed. If we have too much potassium on the outside of the nerve body, then that is inside will not see the need for coming out. Not all of the potassium comes out of the cell process every time we send a nerve impulse along, only enough to adjust the electrical fields around the nerve process. So if we already have too much potassium out there, we cannot make this transfer, and therefore the impulse does not go along. And a lot of impulses that we could send along our nerve chains simply will not go along. And so we get a certain confusion that comes from simply eating too much food. Then, of course, many of you know that a lot of illnesses, physical illnesses such as cancer, a full 35% of cancers are known to be associated with just eating too much, overeating of any kind. Now the next thing, item number 5 in those things that you should do to combat depression is that of the calming diet. Now let's discuss the calming diet just a little bit. Number 1 is no stimulating or irritating foods. That would be pepper, spices, vinegar, pickles, mayonnaise, ketchup, mustard, fermented foods such as sauerkraut, cheese, and soy sauce, and of course wines and alcohol, and unripe or spoiled foods. All of these can stimulate the nervous system. By the way, I'm sure that many of you know that vitamins and minerals can also stimulate our metabolic systems. There are some people who go down to the doctor's office once a week for a B12 shot and come away feeling really great. It is because of the stimulating quality of vitamin B12. And many other vitamins will do the same kind of thing. They have a stimulus. They make a stimulus to the metabolic systems. Far from this being a recommendation for it, it is the very reverse. It's somewhat like coffee. Coffee stimulates the metabolic systems, but that is no recommendation for it. In the doing of that, it also makes our flame burn much hotter, which of course wears us out much quicker. And so the same thing could be said of B12 injections, if we get a stimulus and a sense of well-being after having the shot, this does not mean at all that we were, or does not necessarily mean that we were deficient in B12, but simply that we get a stimulus from it. Many people get the same kind of stimulus from pepper and spices and vinegar. These do irritate. Now, because they irritate the stomach, they can make the stomach empty a little sooner. And, of course, that's one of the reasons why we have the sweet, sweet dessert after a meal. The presence of the sweet dessert irritates the stomach, makes the stomach contract a little bit more fat, a little bit more rapidly, and also a little bit more forcefully because of the irritation, and that makes the stomach empty a little better, which merely dumps a lot of nutrients into the bloodstream and causes a metabolic tax. So all of these things need to be in moderation. That's why the Bible teaches moderation in all things. We should have this as one of our characteristics. Spices are also known to increase one's risk of cancer. That country of the world where there are more cancers of the intestinal tract than any other is also that country of the world where more spices are used. India, followed by Mexico, followed by Korea. And these are the three countries in the world where there are more spices used than any other countries of the world. Now, so far as vinegar is concerned, vinegar irritates the delicate lining systems, causes a break in the mucus barrier of the stomach, and by doing so, increases our risk for getting peptic ulcers or gastritis. It also increases our risk of getting any kind of serious infection that we could get from our food, such as cholera or typhoid, since we expect that these germs will be killed by a properly functioning stomach if we have adequate stomach acid, which is hydrochloric acid. This kind of acid can make us sterilize, or can enable us to sterilize the food that we have eaten. But if we take a lot of vinegar, the vinegar causes alterations in the total chemical balance of the contents of the stomach and makes it so that we are not so efficient in killing germs. We find vinegar in pickles and mayonnaise, ketchup and mustard, and a variety of other things. It is better for us if we leave out vinegar altogether, since vinegar not only causes a problem with a local irritation of the stomach, but vinegar also irritates the nerves. When we come to the point in our social arrangements and in our religious experience where we desire above all things that we might have a well-controlled life, it is at that time that we will begin to read labels. And if there is something on a label that we do not allow, we simply put that back on the shelf and purchase something that does not offend our consciences. Now, what about spoiled foods such as cheese, soy sauce, and other spoiled foods of this nature? Spoiled foods also cause a serious problem for the body because of the products of spoiling or the products of fermentation. Many of these are toxic to the body in a variety of ways. They're toxic either because of the fact that they reduce our ability to ward off viruses that cause cancer or any other kind of virus, or they may potentiate the cancer-producing quality of some other kind of chemical. So this, we can thereby understand that vinegar is not good for us. Sauerkraut also falls in that same category. Now, very hot or very cold foods can give a problem for the stomach, not only for the stomach, but also for the whole system. I'm sure that you have taken a cold food and realized that you were in a tremor, or that you had some unusual feeling about the mouth. Some people will actually get a headache from taking cold foods. This is called an ice cream headache in some quarters, or a soft drink headache. Some people get it from taking very cold foods. Very hot foods can do the same kind of thing. Now, coffee, tea, colas, and chocolate are very notorious causes of depression, and I will have more to say about these at a later time, but merely to tell you now that these foods or beverages that contain methylxanthines are important causes of serious disease among us. The behavioral effects of coffee result from a blockage of the brain opiates. Some of you may have been studying about the brain opiates. These are naturally occurring substances or chemicals that help to keep us in good health. Now, there may be some questions, and if so, we'll take those right now. Did you have one?
Thank you. Dr. Jarvis, and there are several people across the country that are talking about the vinegar and honey
uh-huh.
help balance the pH in our system.
Yes.
I just wondered, after hearing you, obviously.
I'm afraid we'll need to put that in the category of old wives' tales. The question was about vinegar and honey and how it balances the system. It really does not. All right, I can take one more question. Yes?
Is there something helpful?
Question is there helpful sauerkraut? And the answer is yes. You may shred cabbage, can it with lemon juice, and that's a helpful sauerkraut. But it's canned. It has not been preserved by fermentation. Fermentation is the action of bacteria on the carbohydrates. So if we preserve it by canning and you make the flavor, you adjust the flavor by lemon juice, you'll have the same kind of thing. All right, time is up for this section. If any of you have questions, if you will just write them down, we'll have a time at a later time for the answering of questions.
You have been listening to another special American Christian Ministries presentation. This is a digital recording for optimum sound quality. International copyright, all rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.americanchristianministry.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. You can trust ACM. There's no compromise here. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with the speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He is coming soon.